The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas. Performance copyright 1998 by Brilliance Corporation. All rights reserved. One. The three presents of Monsieur D'Artagnan, the father. On the first Monday of the month of April, 1625, the small town of Meung, the birthplace of the author of the Romance of the Rose, appeared to be in a state of revolution, as complete as if the Huguenots were come to make a second siege of La Rochelle. Many of the townsmen, observing the flight along the high street of women who left their children to squall at the doorsteps, hastened to don their armour, and fortifying their courage, which was inclined to fail, with a musket or a partisan, proceeded towards the inn of the Jolly Miller, to which a vast and accumulating mob was hastening with intense curiosity. At that period alarms were frequent, and few days passed without some bourg or other registering in its archives an event of this description. There were the nobles who made war on each other. There was the king who made war on the cardinal. There was the Spaniard who made war on the king. Then, besides these wars, concealed or overt, secret or public, there were bandits, mendicants, Huguenots, wolves, and lackeys who made war on the whole world. The townsmen always armed themselves against the bandits, the wolves, and the lackeys, frequently against the nobles and the Huguenots, sometimes against the king, but never against the cardinal or the Spaniard. From this custom, therefore, it arose that on the aforesaid first Monday in the month of April 1625, the burghers, hearing a noise, and seeing neither the yellow and red flag, nor the livery of the Duke of Richelieu, rushed towards the inn of the Jolly Miller. Having reached it, every one could see and understand the cause of this alarm. A young man... But let us trace his portrait with one stroke of the pen. Fancy to yourself Don Quixote at 18. Don Quixote peeled, without his coat of mail or greaves. Don Quixote clothed in a woolen doublet, whose blue colour was changed to an undyeable shade, a shade between the lees of wine and a cerulean blue. The countenance long and brown, the cheekbones high, denoting acuteness, the muscles of the jaw enormously developed, an infallible mark by which a Gascon may be recognized, even without the cap, and our youth wore a cap, adorned with a sort of feather. The eye full and intelligent, the nose hooked, but finely formed, the whole figure too large for a youth, yet too small for an adult. An inexperienced eye would have taken him for the son of a farmer on a journey, had it not been for the long sword which, hanging from a leathern belt, banged against the heels of its owner whilst he was walking, and against the rough coat of his steed when he was mounted. For our youth had a steed, and this steed was at the same time so remarkable as to attract observation. It was a Bonnie's Sheltie, of about 12 or 14 years of age, yellow as an orange, without any hair on its tail, but abundance of galls on its legs, and which, whilst carrying its head lower than its knees, making the application of a martingale unnecessary, yet managed gallantly its 8 leagues a day. Unfortunately, these useful qualities of the steed were so well concealed under its strange coat and eccentric gait, that at a time when everyone knew something of horses, the apparition of the aforesaid Sheltie at Meung, which it had entered about a quarter of an hour before, by the gate of Beaugency, produced a somewhat unfavourable sensation or impression, which extended even to its master. And this impression was the more painful to young D'Artagnan, for that was the name of the Don Quixote of this second Rosinante, that he could not conceal from himself the ridiculous light in which he, albeit so good a horseman, was placed by such a steed. He had, therefore, sighed deeply when he accepted the gift from Monsieur D'Artagnan, his father. He knew that such a beast was worth about 20 francs. It is true that the words which accompanied the present were above price. "My son," said the Gascon gentleman, in that pure Bonnese patois or dialect which Henry IV could never entirely shake off, "my son, this horse was born in the paternal homestead about 13 years ago, and has remained in it ever since, which ought to make you regard it with affection. Never sell it, Let it die honourably of old age and in tranquillity. And should you make a campaign with it, take as much care of it as you would of an old servant. At the court, if you should ever have the honour to be presented, an honour, however, to which your long line of noble ancestors entitles you, support with dignity the name of gentleman, which has been honourably borne by your ancestors, for the sake of you and yours, for more than 500 years. Never submit quietly to the slightest indignity, except it proceed from the cardinal or the king. It is by his courage, mark this well, it is by his courage alone that a gentleman makes his way nowadays. Whoever hesitates one moment lets perhaps that chance escape him which fortune for that moment alone has offered him. You are young and ought to be brave for two reasons. The first, because you are a Gascon. The second, because you are my son. Have no fear of many imbroglios, and look about for adventures. You have been taught to handle the sword. You have muscles of iron, a wrist like steel. Fight whenever you can, the more so because duels are forbidden, and consequently it requires twice as much courage to fight. I have to give you but 15 crowns, my son, besides the horse, and the advice which you have heard. Your mother will add to them the recipe for a certain balsam, which she received from a Bohemian woman, and which has the miraculous power of curing every wound which has fallen short of the heart. Take advantage of all, and live long and happily. I have only one word more to add, and it is the offer of an example, not my own, for I have never been at court. I have only served in the religious wars as a volunteer. I wish to speak to you of Monsieur de Treville, once my neighbour, who has had the honour of playing, whilst a boy, with our king, Louis XIII, whom God preserve. Sometimes their play turned to battles, and in these battles the king did not always conquer. Yet his conquests by Monsieur de Treville imbued him with a great deal of esteem and friendship for him. Afterwards, Monsieur de Treville fought other battles. Indeed, merely during his journey to Paris he fought 5 times. From the death of the late monarch to the majority of the young king, he has fought 7 times, without reckoning campaigns and sieges. And since that majority till now, perhaps 100 times. And yet, in spite of edicts, ordinances, and writs, behold him now captain of the musketeers. That is, chief of a legion of Caesars, upon whom the king mainly depends, and who are feared by the cardinal, who, as everyone knows, is not easily alarmed. Moreover, Monsieur de Treville gains 10,000 crowns a year, and therefore is a man of consequence. He began the world as you do. Go to him with this letter, and let your conduct be regulated by him, that you may meet with the same results. Hereupon Monsieur d'Artagnan, the father, girded his own sword upon his son, tenderly kissed him on either cheek, and gave him his blessing. Leaving the paternal chamber, the young man found his mother waiting with the famous recipe, which, from the advice he had just received, it seemed very probable that he would require to use pretty often. The adieus were longer and more tender on this side than on the other. Not but that Monsieur d'Artagnan loved his son, who was his only child, but that Monsieur d'Artagnan was a man who would have considered it unworthy of himself to give way to any sentiment, whilst Madame d'Artagnan was a woman, and what is more, a mother. She wept much, and, to the credit of Monsieur d'Artagnan the younger, we may as well say that whatever efforts he made to remain firm, as became the future musketeer, nature gained the day, and he shed many tears, some of which he had great difficulty in concealing. Our youth took his way the same day, furnished with the 3 paternal gifts, which were, as we have said, the 15 crowns, the steed, and the letter to Monsieur de Treville. As may well be imagined, the advice was thrown into the bargain. With such a vade mecum, d'Artagnan found himself, morally and physically, the counterpart of the hero of Cervantes, to whom we so happily compared him, when our duty as his historian obliged us to draw his portrait. Don Quixote took windmills for giants and sheep for armies. D'Artagnan considered every smile an insult, and even a look a provocation. Therefore his fist was doubled from Tarbes to Meung, and from one cause or another his hand was on the pommel of his sword 10 times a day. However, the fist did not descend upon any jaw, nor did the sword leave its scabbard. It was not that the unlucky yellow sheltie did not excite many a smile on the countenances of passers-by, but as beside the said yellow sheltie clashed a sword of respectable length, and above the sword glistened an eye rather stern than fierce, the wayfarers repressed their mirth, or if their mirth surpassed their prudence, they took care only to laugh on one side of their faces, like the ancient masks. D'Artagnan, therefore, remained dignified and uninterrupted in his susceptibility, even to this fatal town of Meung. But there, when he dismounted at the door of the Jolly Miller, without anyone, either landlord, waiter, or hostler, coming to hold the stirrup of his horse, D'Artagnan perceived at the open window of a room, on the ground floor, a gentleman of distinguished air and handsome figure, although with a countenance slightly grim, conversing with two persons who appeared to listen to him with deference. D'Artagnan naturally thought, according to his usual custom, that they were talking about him, and listened accordingly. This time, however, he was partly correct. He was not the subject of conversation, but his horse was. The gentleman appeared to be enumerating to his hearers all his qualities, and since, as I have said, his hearers appeared to pay him great deference, they every moment laughed heartily. Now, since even the slightest smile was sufficient to rouse the anger of our youth, we may well imagine what effect such unbounded mirth was likely to produce upon him. Nevertheless, D'Artagnan wished first to examine the countenance of the impertinent fellow who thus laughed at him. He therefore fixed his stern look upon the stranger, and saw a man from 40 to 45 years of age, with eyes black and piercing, complexion pale, nose strongly marked, and moustache black and carefully trimmed. He was attired in a violet-coloured doublet and breeches, with points of the same colour, with no other ornament than the sleeves through which the shirt passed. This doublet and these breeches, though new, displayed divers wrinkles and creases, as if they had been for some time packed up in a portmanteau. D'Artagnan made these observations with the rapidity of a most minute observer, and doubtless with an instinct which told him that this unknown was to have a vast influence on his future life. At the very moment that D'Artagnan fixed his eyes upon the gentleman with the violet doublet, that individual made one of his wisest and most profound remarks upon the Bonese sheltie. His two auditors roared with laughter, and he himself, contrary to his usual custom, permitted a sort of sickly smile to wander over his countenance. This time there was no room for doubt. D'Artagnan was really insulted. Being convinced of this, he pulled his cap over his eyes, and trying to imitate the courtly airs which he had seen among some chance Gascon nobility in their provincial visits, he placed one hand on the guard of his sword and the other on his hip. Unfortunately, the nearer he advanced, the more angry he grew, so that instead of the high and dignified language which he had prepared as the prelude to his challenge, he found nothing at the tip of his tongue but a rough personality, which he accompanied with a furious gesture. "Hullo, sir!" he cried. "You, sir, who hide yourself behind the shutter! Yes, you! Tell me what you are laughing at, and we will laugh together!" The gentleman slowly turned his eyes from the steed to his rider, as if it required some time to comprehend that these strange reproaches were addressed to himself. Then, when he could no longer doubt it, he slightly knit his brows, and after a pretty long pause, with an accent of irony and insolence impossible to describe, answered D'Artagnan, "I am not speaking to you, sir." "But I am speaking to you!" cried the young man, exasperated by this mixture of insolence and good manners, this polite contempt. The unknown regarded him yet a moment with a slight smile, and then, leaving the window, slowly sauntered out of the inn, and stationed himself opposite the horse, at 2 paces from D'Artagnan. His calm face and jeering aspect redoubled the mirth of his companions, who still remained at the window. D'Artagnan, seeing him come out, drew his sword a foot out of its scabbard. "This horse decidedly is, or rather has been, a buttercup," continued the unknown, pursuing his remarks and addressing his auditors at the window without appearing to notice the exasperation of D'Artagnan, who, nevertheless, swelled and strutted between them. "It is of a colour," he continued, "well known in botany, but as yet very rare amongst horses." "A man may laugh at a horse who would not dare to laugh at its master," cried the disciple of Treville with fury. "I do not often laugh, sir," answered the unknown, "as you may yourself discover by the expression of my countenance. But yet I mean to preserve the right of laughing when I please."
"And I," roared out D'Artagnan, "do not permit anyone to laugh when I do not please."
"Really, sir," continued the unknown, more quietly than ever. "Well, that is sound sense." And turning on his heel, he essayed to re-enter the inn by the front door, opposite which D'Artagnan, on arriving, had observed a horse ready saddled. But D'Artagnan was not the man to let anyone who had had the insolence to mock him thus escape. He therefore drew his sword and pursued him, exclaiming, "Turn, turn, master jester, that I may not strike you behind."
"Strike me?" said the other, quickly turning round and regarding the youth with as much astonishment as contempt. "Go along with you, my dear boy, you are mad."
Then, in a low voice, as if he were speaking to himself, he added, "It is annoying. What a prize for his majesty, who is everywhere seeking fire-eaters to recruit his guards." He had scarcely finished when D'Artagnan made such a furious thrust at him that, had he not jumped back briskly, it is probable the jest would have been his last. Perceiving now, however, that the affair was beyond a joke, the unknown drew his sword, saluted his adversary, and gravely put himself on guard. But at the same moment his two auditors, accompanied by the host, fell pell-mell upon D'Artagnan with sticks, shovels, and tongs. This caused such a complete diversion of the attack that, whilst D'Artagnan himself turned to face this shower of blows, his opponent put up his sword with the same calm as before, and, from an actor, became a spectator of the combat, a character which he supported with the same imperturbability, yet all the time muttering, "Plague upon these Gascons! Put him on his orange-coloured horse and let him go!"
"Not before I've slain you, you coward!" cried D'Artagnan,
all the time making the best resistance he could, and not yielding one step to his three opponents, who showered their blows upon him.
"Yet another Gasconade," murmured the gentleman. "Upon my word, these Gascons are incorrigible. Keep up the dance, since he actually wishes it. When he's tired, he will say that he has had enough."
But the stranger did not yet know with what a stubborn personage he had to deal. D'Artagnan was not the man ever to sue for quarter. The contest, therefore, continued for some moments longer, until at last, completely worn out, D'Artagnan dropped his sword, which was broken in two by a blow from a stick, while at the same instant another blow, which cut open his forehead, stretched him on the ground almost senseless. It was now that all the burghers hastened to the scene of action. Fearing a disturbance, the landlord, assisted by his servants, carried the wounded man into the kitchen, where some care was given him. As for the stranger, he returned to the window and viewed the crowd with evident marks of impatience, seeming rather annoyed at their refusal to go away.
"Well, how is that madman now?" said he, turning and addressing the host, who came to inquire in what state his guest was. "Is your excellency safe and well?"
demanded the host.
"Yes, perfectly so, mine host. But I wish to know what has become of this youth."
"He is better," replied the host. "But he was quite senseless."
"Indeed," said the gentleman.
"But before he quite lost his senses, he rallied all his strength to challenge and defy you,"
added the landlord.
"Well, this young fellow is the very devil himself," said the gentleman.
"Oh, no, your excellency, oh, no!" replied the host, with a contemptuous grin. "He is not the devil. For while he was senseless, we rummaged his outfit. And in his bundle we found but one shirt, and in his pocket only 12 crowns, which fact, however, did not prevent his saying, just before he fainted, that had this happened in Paris, you should quickly have repented it. But as it has taken place here, you will not have to repent it until later.
Therefore, coolly observed the stranger, he doubtless is a prince of the blood in disguise.
I give you this information, sir, said the host, that you may keep yourself on your guard.
And did he not name anyone in his anger?
Yes, he slapped his pocket and said, we shall see what Monsieur de Treville will say to this insult offered to his protégé.
Monsieur de Treville, said the unknown, becoming more attentive. He slapped his pocket and mentioned the name of Monsieur de Treville? Let us see, my good host. Whilst this young man was senseless, you did not fail, I am sure, to examine that pocket. What did it contain?
A letter addressed to Monsieur de Treville, captain of the musketeers.
Really?
Just as I have the honour to tell your excellency, said the host.
The latter, who had no great penetration, did not remark the expression which these words brought upon the countenance of the stranger, who now left the window-sill on which his elbow had rested, and frowned like a man disturbed all of a sudden.
The devil, muttered he between his teeth. Could Treville have sent this Gascon? He is very young, but a thrust of a sword is a thrust of a sword, whatever may be the age of him that gives it, and one distrusts a boy less than an oldster. A slight obstacle is sufficient to thwart a project.
And the stranger fell into a reverie which lasted some minutes.
Come, mine host, at length he said, will you not rid me of this madman? I cannot conscientiously kill him, and yet, he added with a menacing air, he much annoys me. Where is he? In my wife's chamber, on the first story, where they are dressing his wounds.
Are his clothes and his bag with him?
Has he taken off his doublet? On the contrary, they are below in the kitchen, said the host. But since this young madman annoys you, doubtless he causes a disturbance in your inn which no respectable people can bear. Go to your room, make out my bill, and give orders to my servants. What, sir, must you be off? Yes. I ordered you to saddle my horse. Have I not been obeyed? Yes, and your excellency may see your horse standing under the grand entrance, quite ready for the road. Very well. Then do as I have ordered. Heyday, said the host to himself. Can he be afraid of this young boy?
But a commanding look from the stranger cut him short. He humbly bowed and left the apartment.
My lady must not see this strange fellow, said the stranger. As she is already late, she must soon pass. I had better mount my horse and go to meet her. If I could only just learn the contents of that letter addressed to Treville.
And thus muttering, the unknown descended to the kitchen. In the meantime, the landlord, who doubted not that this youth's presence drove the stranger from his inn, had gone to his wife's chamber, and found that D'Artagnan had regained consciousness. Then, whilst he made him comprehend that the police might be severe on him for having attacked a great lord, for according to the host's idea, the stranger could be nothing less than a great lord, he persuaded him, in spite of his weakness, to resume his journey. D'Artagnan, half stunned, without doublet, his head completely bandaged, arose, and pushed out by the host, began to descend the stairs. But on reaching the kitchen, the first object he saw was his opponent, who was quietly talking at the door of a heavy carriage, drawn by 2 large Norman horses. The person with whom he conversed was a woman of from 20 to 22 years of age, whose head appeared, through the window of the carriage, like a picture in a frame. We have already said how rapidly D'Artagnan caught the expression of a countenance. He saw, therefore, at the first glance, that the lady was young and attractive. Now, this beauty was the more striking to him, as it was completely different from that of his own southern country. She was a pale, fair person, with long, curling hair falling on her shoulders, large, blue, languishing eyes, rosy lips, and alabaster hands. She conversed with the unknown with great vivacity.
"So his eminence commands me," said she, "to return immediately to England and apprise him with all speed whether the Duke has left London," said the unknown.
And as to my other instructions? Demanded the fair traveller.
They are enclosed in this box, which you will not open until you are on the other side of the channel.
Good. And you? What are you going to do?
I return to Paris.
Without chastising this insolent boy? Demanded the lady.
The unknown was about to reply, but ere he could do so, D'Artagnan, who had heard every word, rushed to the doorway.
"It is that insolent boy!" he cried, "who chastises others, and I hope that this time he who deserves chastisement will not escape him!"
"Will not escape him?" echoed the unknown, knitting his brows.
"No! In the presence of a woman you would hesitate to fly, I presume."
"Consider," said the lady, seeing the gentleman place his hand to his sword, "consider that the slightest delay might ruin all."
"You are right," said the gentleman. "You go your way, and I will go mine." And, saluting the lady with a bow, he got into the saddle, whilst the coachman whipped his horses. The lady and gentleman, therefore, went off at a gallop towards the opposite ends of the street.
"Hollo! Your bill!"
shouted mine host, whose affection for the traveller was changed to the most profound contempt when he saw him departing without paying.
"Pay, rascal!"
cried the traveller as he galloped off to his valet, who threw 3 or 4 pieces of silver at the feet of the landlord, and set off at full speed the way his master went.
"Oh, coward! Wretch! False-hearted gentleman!"
cried D'Artagnan, rushing after the valet. But he was still too feeble from his wounds to bear such an effort. Scarcely had he gone 10 paces before his ears tingled, a vertigo seized him, a cloud passed before his eyes, and he fell down in the street with a final cry of, "Coward! Coward! Coward!"
"He is a sad coward, verily," murmured the host,
who now, approaching D'Artagnan, endeavoured to soothe him by this flattery, as the heron in the fable her friend the snail.
"Yes, a sad coward," murmured D'Artagnan. "But she is beautiful."
"Who is she?"
said the landlord.
"My lady," murmured D'Artagnan,
and again fainted away.
"Never mind," said the host. "Although I have lost 2, at any rate I have secured this one, whom I am sure of keeping for some days. At all events, I shall gain 11 crowns."
It must be borne in mind that 11 crowns was the exact sum which remained in D'Artagnan's purse, and the host had reckoned upon 11 days' illness at a crown a day. On this point, however, he reckoned without his guest. The following day D'Artagnan left his couch, went down to the kitchen, and, besides certain ingredients, the names of which have not descended to posterity, demanded some wine, oil, and rosemary, which, with his mother's recipe in his hand, he compounded into a salve, wherewith he anointed his numerous wounds, renewing his plasters himself, and not allowing the interposition of any leech. Thanks, no doubt, to the Bohemian salve, and perhaps also to the absence of the leech, D'Artagnan found himself on foot in the evening, and almost cured by the next day. But at the moment he was paying for this wine, oil, and rosemary, the sole expense he had incurred, for he had been completely abstinent, whilst, on the contrary, if one believed the hostler, the yellow horse had eaten 3 times as many oats as one would have supposed possible from his size, D'Artagnan found nothing in his pocket but his little purse, with its 11 crowns. As for the letter to Monsieur de Treville, that was gone. The young man began by looking very patiently for this letter, turning out and rummaging his pockets and fobs 20 times, rummaging his valise again and again, and opening and shutting his purse. But when he was quite convinced that the letter was not to be found, he gave full vent to another fit of rage in a manner which was like to make necessary a second decoction of wine and spiced oil. For upon beholding this young scatterbrain raging and threatening to destroy everything in his establishment if the letter were not found, the host had already seized upon a spit, his wife upon the handle of a broom, and the servants upon the same weapons they had wielded the evening before.
"My letter of introduction!" cried D'Artagnan. "My letter of introduction! Or, by Saint-Denis, I will spit you all like so many ortolans!"
One circumstance prevented the youth from accomplishing his threat, which was that his sword, as we have said, had unfortunately been broken in 2 in the first struggle, a mischance he had entirely forgotten.
Consequently, when D'Artagnan went to draw it in earnest, he found himself armed only with the stump, about 8 or 10 inches long, which the host had carefully thrust into the scabbard. As for the rest of the blade, the cook had adroitly set it aside for a larding pin. And yet it is probable that this deception would not have stopped our fiery youth, had not the host reflected that the demand which his guest made was perfectly just.
"But after all," said he, lowering his spit, "where is this letter?"
"Yes, where is this letter?" roared D'Artagnan. "And let me tell you that this letter is for Monsieur de Tréville, and that it must be found. Otherwise Monsieur de Tréville will know to have it found. I'll answer for it."
This threat completely frightened mine host. Next to the king and the cardinal, Monsieur de Tréville was the man whose name was most frequently in the mouths of the military, and indeed of the citizens. There was, certainly, Father Joseph, but his name was never mentioned except in an undertone, so great was the terror which his grey eminence, as the familiar of the cardinal was called, inspired. Therefore, throwing away his spit and ordering his wife to do the same with her broom-handle, and the servants with their weapons, he himself set the example by commencing a diligent search for the letter.
"Did this letter contain anything valuable?"
said he, after some moments of fruitless search.
"I should rather think it did!"
cried the Gascon, who calculated on the letter to make his way at court.
"It contained my fortune!"
"Were they bills on the Bank of Spain?"
demanded the host, much disturbed.
"Bills on the private treasury of his Majesty,"
replied D'Artagnan, who, calculating on entering the king's service through this letter of introduction, thought he might, without lying, make this somewhat rash reply.
"The devil!"
exclaimed the host, at his wit's end.
"But it is of no consequence," continued D'Artagnan, with his native assurance. "The money is nothing. The letter is all I want. I'd rather have lost 1,000 pistoles than that."
He might as well have made it 20,000, but a certain youthful modesty restrained him. A sudden flash of light illumined the mind of the host, who was uttering maledictions at finding nothing.
"This letter is not lost!" he cried.
"It isn't?" said D'Artagnan.
"No, it has been taken from you."
"Taken? And by whom?"
"By the stranger, yesterday. He went into the kitchen where your doublet was lying. He was there for a time entirely alone. And I will lay a wager it was he who stole it from you."
"You really think so?"
said D'Artagnan, only half convinced, for he knew better than anybody the strictly personal value of the letter, and saw nothing in it to excite cupidity. The fact is that none of the servants or travellers who were there could have gained anything by the theft.
"You say, then," continued D'Artagnan, "that you suspect this impertinent gentleman?"
"I tell you that I'm quite certain of it," said the host. "When I informed him that your worship was the protégé of Monsieur de Tréville, and that you had a letter for that illustrious noble, he appeared much disturbed, demanded where the letter was, and immediately went into the kitchen where your doublet was lying."
"Then he is the robber," said D'Artagnan. "I will complain to Monsieur de Tréville, and he will lay my complaint before his majesty."
And he majestically drew from his pocket 2 crowns, which he handed to the host, who followed him cap in hand to the archway, where he remounted his yellow horse, which carried him without further accident to the gate of Saint Antoine at Paris. There its owner sold the animal for 3 crowns, which was a good price, considering that D'Artagnan had overridden him in the last part of the journey. The dealer to whom he sold the sheltie for these 9 francs did not conceal from the young man that he paid this exorbitant sum merely on account of the originality of his colour. D'Artagnan, therefore, entered Paris on foot, carrying his small valise under his arm, and proceeded until he found a lodging suitable to his slender resources. This chamber was a sort of garret, situated in the Rue des Fossoyeurs, near the Luxembourg. Having paid the luckpenny, he took possession of his lodging, and passed the remainder of the day in sewing on his doublet and breeches sundry laces which his mother had secretly taken from a nearly new doublet of the elder Monsieur D'Artagnan. He then repaired to the Quai de la Ferraille to procure a new blade for his sword, after which he returned to the Louvre, and learned from the first musketeer he met where Monsieur de Tréville's hotel was situated. This he ascertained to be in the Rue de Vieux Colombier, that is, in the very neighbourhood where he had himself taken up his abode. a circumstance which he construed into a happy omen of the success of his expedition. These matters disposed of, and satisfied with the manner in which he had behaved at Meung, without remorse for the past, confident in the present, and full of hope for the future, he went to bed and slept the sleep of the brave. This sleep, still that of a rustic, lasted till 9 o'clock in the morning, the hour at which he rose to repair to the hotel of this famed Monsieur de Treville, who, according to D'Artagnan's father, was the third personage in the realm. 2. The Antechamber of Monsieur de Treville. Monsieur de Troisville, as his family was yet called in Gascony, or Monsieur de Treville, as he called himself in Paris, had actually begun life like D'Artagnan, that is to say, without being worth a sou, but with that fund of audacity, esprit, and resolution which makes the poorest Gascon gentleman often inherit more in imagination than the richest nobleman of Périgord or Berry receives in reality. His daring and haughty courage, still more haughty in success, at the time when blows fell thick as hail, had raised him to the top of that difficult ladder which is called court favour, and which he had climbed 4 rungs at a time. He was the confidential friend of the king, who, as everyone knows, greatly honoured the memory of his father, Henry IV. The father of Monsieur de Treville had served the latter so faithfully in his wars against the League that, for want of ready money, a commodity which, during his life, was very scarce with the Bernese, who constantly paid his debts with what he never had occasion to borrow, that is to say, with his genius, for want of ready money, as we have said, he had authorized him, after the reduction of Paris, to take for his arms un lion d'or passant sur gueule, with the motto Fidelis et Fortis. It was a great deal of honour, but not much profit. Therefore, when the illustrious companion of Henri the Great died, the sole inheritance he left his son was his sword, with the arms and motto. Thanks, however, to this double legacy, and to the name without tarnish which accompanied it, Monsieur de Treville was admitted into the household of the young prince, where he made such good use of his sword, and was so true to his motto, that Louis XIII, one of the best hands with a rapier in his own kingdom, used to say that if he had a friend who was going to fight, he would advise him to take for a second, first himself, and then Treville, or even perhaps Treville before himself. On this account, Louis had a real affection for Treville, a royal affection, an egotistical affection, it must be allowed, but an affection nevertheless. In those unhappy days, it was an important consideration to surround oneself with men of Treville's stamp. Many could take for their device the epithet of Fortis, which formed the second part of the motto, but very few men could claim the epithet Fidelis, which formed the first part of it. Treville was one of the few. His was one of those rare organizations with the intelligence and obedience of the mastiff, and a blind courage and a ready hand, one to whom the eye had been given only to see whether the king was dissatisfied with anyone, and the hand only to strike the offending person, a Baime, a Montrevert, a Poltrot de Marais, a Vitry. In short, Treville only wanted an opportunity, but he watched for it, and was resolved to seize it by its 3 hairs if ever it came within reach of his grasp. Louis XIII, therefore, appointed Treville captain of the musketeers, who, by their devotion, or rather fanaticism, became what his ordinary troops were to Henry III, and his Scottish guard to Louis XI. In this respect, the cardinal was not behind the king. For when he saw the formidable picked guard with which Louis surrounded himself, this second, or rather this first, king of France wished also to have his own guard. He, therefore, as well as the king, had his musketeers. And these 2 potent rivals were seen selecting for their service from all the provinces of France, and even from all foreign countries, men famous for their skill as swordsmen. It was not rare for Richelieu and the king, over their game of chess in the evening, to dispute concerning the merits of their respective followers. Each boasted of the deportment and the courage of his own, and whilst openly inveighing against duels and imbroglios, they secretly excited their respective partisans to fight, and experienced immoderate delight, or intense chagrin, at their respective victories or defeats. Thus, at least, says the memoir of one who was concerned in some of these defeats and many of these victories. Treville had seized on the weak point in his master's character, and to this knowledge he owed the long and constant favour of a king who has not left behind him the reputation of having been constant in his friendships. He paraded his musketeers before the Cardinal Armand Duplessis with an air of insolence which made the grey moustache of his eminence curl with anger. Treville also thoroughly understood the war of that period, when, if you lived not at the expense of the enemy, you lived at that of your countrymen. His soldiers formed a legion of very devils, under no discipline but his own. Swaggering bullies given to wine, the king's musketeers, or rather Monsieur de Treville's, spread themselves through the taverns, the public walks, and the theatres, talking loud, curling their moustaches, jingling their swords, hustling the guards of the cardinal when they met them, indulging in the open street in a thousand jokes, sometimes killed, but then certain of being lamented and avenged, sometimes killing, but then quite certain not to languish in prison, since Monsieur de Treville was always at hand to procure their pardon and release. Therefore Monsieur de Treville was lauded in every tone, sung of in every key by these men who adored him. Yet, hangdogs as they were, they trembled before him as scholars before their master, obedient to a word, and ready to meet death to wipe away any reproach. Monsieur de Treville had used this powerful lever first for the king and his friends, and next for himself and his own friends. The captain of the musketeers was, therefore, admired, feared, and loved, which state constitutes the apogee of human affairs. Louis XIV absorbed all the lesser stars of his court by his vast brilliancy, but his father, sol pluribus impar, imparted his personal splendour to many of his favourites, his individual valour to each of his courtiers. Besides the king's levy and that of the cardinal, there were then at Paris at least 200 smaller ones, fairly exclusive, and amongst these 200 smaller levies, that of Monsieur de Treville was one of the most frequented. From 6 o'clock in the morning during summer, and 8 in the winter, the courtyard of his hotel in the Rue du Vieux Colombier resembled a camp. From 50 to 60 musketeers, who appeared to relieve each other, and to present a number always imposing, were stalking about incessantly, armed to the teeth and ready for anything. From one end to the other of one of those long staircases, on whose space our modern civilization would build an entire mansion, ascended and descended those petitioners who sought favours, with provincial gentlemen eager to be enrolled, and liveried lackeys of every colour in the act of delivering messages from their masters to Monsieur de Treville. In the antechamber, on long circular benches, reclined the élite, that is, such of them as had assembled. A continual buzzing prevailed from morning till night, whilst Monsieur de Treville, in his cabinet adjoining the antechamber, received visits, listened to complaints, gave his orders, and, like the king in his balcony at the Louvre, had only to place himself at his window to review his men and their arms. On the day when D'Artagnan presented himself, the assembly was very imposing, especially to a provincial just arrived in Paris. It is true this provincial was a Gascon, and at this period more especially, D'Artagnan's countrymen had the reputation of not being easily intimidated. In fact, as soon as anyone had passed the threshold of the massive door, studded with long square nails, he found himself in the midst of a troop of swordsmen, who were cruising about the court, talking, quarrelling, and jesting with each other. To clear a path through these eddies, it was necessary to be an officer, a man of rank, or a pretty woman. It was, therefore, in the midst of this crowd and disorder that our youth, holding his long rapier against his slender legs, and the rim of his beaver in his hand, advanced with palpitating heart, yet with that sort of half-smile of provincial embarrassment which wishes to create a good impression. When he had passed one group, he breathed more freely, but he perceived that they turned to look at him, and D'Artagnan, who to that day had invariably entertained a pretty good opinion of himself, for the first time in his life thought himself ridiculous. When he had reached the staircase, it was still worse. On the first step were four musketeers, who amused themselves in the following manner, whilst 10 or 12 of their companions waited on the landing place till it was their turn to have a share in the game. One of them, on a higher step, with a naked sword in his hand, prevented, or endeavoured to prevent, the other 3 from mounting the stairs, whilst these 3 skirmished with him very actively with their swords. D'Artagnan at first took these swords for foils and thought they were buttoned, but he soon found by certain scratches that each weapon was as sharp as possible, and at each of these scratches not only the spectators but the actors themselves laughed most heartily. The one who held the higher step at that time kept his opponents at bay in a dexterous manner. A circle was formed round him, the condition of the game being that at every hit he who was struck should relinquish the pastime and surrender his turn of reception by Monsieur de Treville to the one who had touched him. In 5 minutes 3 were grazed, one on the hand, one on the chin, and another on the ear, by this defender of the staircase, who was himself untouched, a proof of his skill which, according to the rules of the game, entitled him to 3 turns of favour. This sport surprised our young traveller, although he did not wish it to appear that he was astonished. He had seen in his own province, that province where, moreover, the fiery passions are so promptly roused, a good many provocatives to duels, and yet the gasconade of these 4 players appeared much stronger than any he had heard of even in Gascony. He fancied he was transported into that famous country of giants where Gulliver afterwards went, and was so much frightened. And yet he had not reached the end. The landing place and antechamber still remained. On the landing place they did not fight, but recounted histories of the fair sex, and in the antechamber tales of the court. On the landing place D'Artagnan blushed. In the antechamber he shuddered. But if his good manners were shocked on the landing place, his respect for the cardinal was scandalized in the antechamber. There, to his great astonishment, he heard the policy which made all Europe tremble, openly criticized, as well as the private life of the cardinal, which so many powerful men had been punished for attempting to scrutinize. That great man whom D'Artagnan's father had so deeply reverenced, Monsieur de Treville and his men made their butt, deriding his bandy legs and crooked back. Some sang carols on Madame d'Aiguillon, his mistress, and Madame de Combalet, his niece, whilst others planned adventures against the pages and guards of the Cardinal Duke himself. All these things appeared to D'Artagnan monstrous impossibilities. Nevertheless, when the name of the king accidentally slipped out in the midst of these jokes on the cardinal, a sort of momentary gag stopped all their jeering mouths. They looked around with hesitation and seemed to doubt the discretion of the wall of Monsieur de Treville's cabinet. But some allusion soon brought back the conversation to his eminence. The wit was of the most brilliant kind, and none of his actions was uncommented upon. Verily, thought D'Artagnan with terror, these gentry will soon be put into the Bastille and hanged. Doubtless I shall accompany them, for having heard all they have said, I shall without doubt be taken for an accomplice. What would my father say, he who enjoined me so strongly to respect the cardinal, if he knew that I was in the company of such reprobates? Of course, while D'Artagnan dared not join in the conversation, he kept his eyes and ears wide open, and every sense on the alert, that he might lose nothing, and in spite of the paternal advice, he found himself drawn by his tastes and instinct rather to praise than blame the incredible things he heard around him. Nevertheless, as he was absolutely a stranger to the crowd of Monsieur de Treville's courtiers, and it was the first time he had been seen there, someone came to inquire what he wanted. At this question he humbly gave his name, relying on his being a countryman, and requested the servant to solicit a moment's audience of Monsieur de Treville, a request which the inquirer, in the tone of a protector, promised to make at the proper time. D'Artagnan, a little recovered from his first surprise, had now time to study the dresses and countenances of those around him. In the midst of the most animated group was a musketeer of great height, of a haughty countenance, and so fantastical a costume as to attract general attention. He did not wear his uniform tunic, which was not absolutely indispensable at that period of less liberty yet greater independence, but a close coat of celestial blue, slightly faded and worn, and on this coat a magnificent border of gold embroidery, which glittered like scales upon a sunlit stream. A long mantle or cloak of crimson velvet hung gracefully from his shoulders, discovering the front alone of his splendid belt, from which depended his enormous rapier. This musketeer, who had just come from guard, complained of having caught cold, and coughed occasionally with great affectation. Therefore, as he averred, he had taken his cloak, and whilst he was talking loudly over the group, and proudly curling his moustache, every one much admired the embroidered belt, and D'Artagnan more than anyone else. "What would you have?" said the musketeer. "It is the fashion. I know very well that it is foolish, but it is the fashion. Besides, one must spend one's hereditary property on something or other." "Ah, Porthos!" cried one of the bystanders. "Do not try to make us believe that this lace comes from the paternal generosity. It was given you by the veiled lady with whom I met you the other Sunday, near the gate of Saint-Honoré." "No, upon my honour and by the faith of a gentleman, I bought it with my own money," said he whom they called Porthos. "Yes, as I bought this new purse with what my mistress put in the old," cried another musketeer. "But it is true," said Porthos, "and the proof is that I paid 12 pistoles for it." The wonder and admiration were redoubled, though the doubt still existed. "Is it not so, Aramis?" inquired Porthos, turning to another musketeer. The person thus appealed to formed a perfect contrast to the one who thus questioned him, and who designated him by the name of Aramis. He was a young man, not more than 22 or 23 years of age, with a soft and ingenuous countenance, a black and mild eye, and cheeks rosy and damask as an autumnal peach. His slender moustache marked a perfect straight line along his upper lip. His hands appeared to dread hanging down, for fear of making their veins swell, and he was continually pinching the tips of his ears to make them preserve a delicate and transparent carnation hue. Habitually he talked little and slowly, often bowed, laughed quietly, merely showing his teeth, which were good, and of which, as of the rest of his person, he appeared to take the greatest care. He replied to his friend's question by affirmative inclination of the head, and this affirmation appeared to settle all doubt concerning the embroidery. They therefore continued to admire it, but said no more about it, and by a sudden change of thought the conversation at once passed to another subject. "What do you think of this story of Chalais' squire?" inquired another musketeer, not addressing anyone in particular, but the company in general. "And what does he say?" demanded Porthos in a conceited tone. "He says that he found Rochefort, the tool of the cardinal, at Brussels, disguised as a Capuchin friar, and that this cursed Rochefort, thanks to his disguise, had deceived Monsieur de Laigne, simpleton as he is." "He is a simpleton," said Porthos. "But is it a fact?" "I heard it from Aramis," answered the musketeer.
"Really?"
"Ah, you know it well enough, Porthos," said Aramis. "I told it you myself yesterday evening. Do not let us talk any more about it."
"Not talk any more about it? That's your view of the matter," said Porthos. "Not talk any more about it. Egad, you would make short work of it. What, the cardinal sets a spy upon a gentleman, robs him of his correspondence through a traitor, a robber, a gallows bird? Cut Chalais's throat through this spy, and by means of this correspondence, under the flimsy pretext that he desired to kill the king, and marry Monsieur to the queen. No one knew one word of this enigma. You told us of it yesterday evening, to the great astonishment of everyone. And whilst we are still all amazed at the news, you come today and say to us, 'Let us talk no more about it.'
Well, then, since it better suits your humour, let us talk about it," calmly replied Aramis.
"Were I poor Chalais' squire," cried Porthos, "this Rochefort would pass a bad minute with me."
"And the Red Duke would make but short work with you," replied Aramis.
"Aha, the Red Duke! Bravo, bravo, the Red Duke!" exclaimed Porthos, with an approving nod and clapping his hands.
The Red Duke is charming. Rest assured, my dear fellow, that I will disseminate the title. What a genius he has, this Aramis! What a pity that you could not follow your vocation, my dear fellow. What an exquisite abbé you would have made.
Oh, it is a mere transitory delay, replied Aramis. One day or other I shall be one. For you well know, Porthos, that I continue to study theology with that intention.
He will actually do as he says, replied Porthos. He will do it, sooner or later.
Very soon, said Aramis.
He only waits for one thing to decide what he will do, and to resume his cassock, which is hung up behind his uniform, replied another musketeer.
And what event does he wait for? Inquired another.
He waits till the Queen has given an heir to the crown of France. Let us not jest on this subject, gentlemen, said Porthos. Thank God the Queen is yet of an age to give it one.
It is said that the Duke of Buckingham is in France, observed Aramis with a mocking laugh, which gave to his remark, simple as it was in appearance, a meaning sufficiently scandalous.
Aramis, my friend, this time you are wrong, rejoined Porthos, and your wit always leads you too far. It would be the worse for you if Monsieur de Treville heard you talking in this manner.
Do not lecture me, Porthos, cried Aramis, in whose soft eye something like the lightning's flash now passed.
My dear fellow, be either musketeer or abbé. Be one or the other, but not one and the other, exclaimed Porthos. You may remember that Athos told you the other day that you eat at every rack. But let us not dispute, I beseech you. It would be perfectly useless. You know what is settled between you and me and Athos. You go to Madame d'Aiguillon's, and you pay her attentions. You then repair to Madame de Boistracy, the cousin of Madame de Chevreuse, and a woman in whose good graces you are thought to stand highly. Nay, my dear fellow, confess not your good fortune. No one demands your secret. Everyone knows your discretion. But since you possess this virtue yourself, surely you will not grudge some portion of it to the Queen? Let who will talk about the King and the Cardinal, but the Queen is sacred, and if you discuss her at all, let it be respectfully.
Porthos, you are as presumptuous as Narcissus, said Aramis. You know that I detest moralizing, except from Athos. As to you, my dear fellow, you have rather too splendid a belt to be powerful on that subject. I will be an abbé if it suits me. In the meantime, I am a musketeer, in which character I say what I choose, and at this moment I choose to tell you that you irritate me.
Aramis! Porthos! That will do, gentlemen! Gentlemen! Cried out all around them.
Monsieur de Treville awaits Monsieur d'Artagnan,
interrupted the lackey, opening the door of the cabinet. At this declaration, during which the door remained open, everyone was silent. And in the midst of this general silence, the young Gascon, passing through part of the antechamber, entered the cabinet of the captain of the musketeers, felicitating himself with all his heart upon just escaping the conclusion of this singular quarrel. 3. The audience. Monsieur de Treville was at this moment in a very bad humor. Nevertheless, as a young man bowed to the ground, he politely saluted him and smiled on receiving his compliments, which, in their accent, recalled both his youth and his country at the same time, a double recollection which makes a man smile at every period of his life. But going towards the antechamber and making a sign with his hand to D'Artagnan, as if requesting permission to finish with others before he began with him, he called 3 times, raising his voice each time so as to run through the intermediate scale between the tone of command and that of anger.
Athos! Porthos! Aramis!
The 2 musketeers, whose acquaintance we have already made, and who answered to the 2 last of these 3 names, immediately quitted the group of which they formed a portion, and advanced towards the cabinet, the door of which was closed immediately they had passed its threshold. Their bearing, although not quite calm, was at the same time full of dignity and submission, and their apparent indifference excited the admiration of D'Artagnan, who saw in these men a species of demigods.